Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, committed to being an objective partner for over 425 employers and their brokers, providing self-funded employers with data to manage their health plans. The-Alliance.org.
It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about new FDA regulations that would restrict antibiotic use in livestock. But first, in a related topic, experts say we are on the brink of a post-antibiotic era.
And part of the problem is there are very few new antibiotics being developed, in part because drug companies don't make as much money off of the drugs because they're taken for short periods of time when people need to use them.
So one effort to solve this problem is the ILiAD Project, which gives the public a chance to participate in his or her own antibiotic research.
Here to explain what this project is, how it works, and how you can join in are the men behind ILiAD: Josiah Zahner, a fellow in synthetic biology at NASA, and Mark Opel, a neurobiologist and drug development specialist. Josiah, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
And Mark, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, guys.
So Josiah, what exactly is the ILiAD Project?
So the ILiAD Project is an open science project. It works on the premise of sending people a kit that provides everything they need to test plants and organisms for antibacterial properties. We named it the ILiAD as an acronym for the International Laboratory for Identification of Antibacterial Drugs, and also because we thought the project would be huge, a huge undertaking and of epic proportions.
Yeah. That's a good source to draw from there. And Mark, if I decided to sign up for ILiAD, what do I do and what would I get?
Yeah, sure. So basically, we have a number of different kits. Right now, the most popular ones called the Super Kit. What you get with that is basically everything that you would need to extract sort of these natural compounds from plants that you might find around your yard or your house. And so that would come in a box, and you'd unwrap it, and basically you go through this three-step process. And without going into too many details, at the end, you can determine whether or not, you know, your leaf or your shrub or your insect had antibiotic activity. And we encourage you to upload your results to the ILiAD Project website. And what that website is just an integrative, an interactive map that shows where everyone is around the world that's tested samples. And then in collaboration with some of our collaborators, we go and then try to independently verify them.
So you embrace social media there, too, to maybe get people on board and get them excited, it sounds like. So, Josiah, I was one of the most inept high school biology students ever. My dissections were unrecognizable. Do you want even people like me, or do you need a little more science skill than I have to participate?
Yeah, no, you know what? To be honest with you, I also wasn't that good at, like, biology in high school. And I think, in part, it's because that the science wasn't exciting. They'd give you an experiment to do, and it would be like, do A, do B, and expect C. And you're just like goofing around, and you never get C, and you're like, why not? But that's not science, you know? Then when I went to college and I went to graduate school, I learned that like science is about discovery. It's about finding new things and seeing things that people haven't seen before. And I think that this is what one of our goals in the project is to teach people what science really is, right? Science is discovery. It's not this like A, B, C, boring, oh, I don't care and easy for me to mess up thing.
So we'll get back into the possible outcomes here. But Mark, part of the goal, apart from finding antibiotics, is to get people involved in doing science and excited about science, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, just to echo Josiah's point, you know, I was actually discouraged from going into science in high school, which is ironic given my title now. And, you know, it really is funny. You know, what we're trying to do is you know, we're trying to basically raise a whole new generation of people, you, your mom, your children, whoever, and get them excited about science through actually doing it. And, you know, this is, you know, might be considered a fun project for, you know, children in school, high school students, so on and so forth. But the really cool part about it is that it could actually have an impact.
And Josiah, you mentioned people just with this kit that they would get in the program would take plants, in particular plant material. Why plants? Is that a proven source in the past of antibiotics?
So yeah, people have found antibiotics in plants before. It's not just plants, but plants are one of the easiest and non-threatening things to suggest to people, right? You can also test insects. We have kits available that allow you to test bacteria, which are a huge source of antibiotics. Test fungus and all these other things, right? Penicillin came from fungus. You know, other streptomycin came from bacteria. So, like, you know, antibiotics have been found from these things before.
And this isn't, we're gonna not going to start any kind of outbreak with people doing these home biology projects, are we, Mark?
No, absolutely not. The bacteria that is provided in the kit is non-pathogenic, which means it's non-disease causing. And that's really not an issue with the kit.
And Josiah, what's the next step then? So I get a hit and I get something from a shrub outside my house and it kills that non-pathogenic bacteria you've sent along. I share my results on social media. How would that be developed then? How would somebody run with that to hopefully turn that into a replicable form of antibiotic that we could use to fight disease?
No, that's a good question. I mean, the first part would be, you know, you post your thing on the internet and people see it and they're like, wow, that was really cool. Let me replicate it, right? Because, you know, people make mistakes, stuff happens. So you get a bunch of people that test it and they're like, wow, we all have the same results. So you have other people helping you out, other people verifying your results. It's part of the scientific process. Next, then we'd see that. We'd contact you, talk a little bit about it, have you send us sample. You know, we'd send you a prepaid envelope. You'd send us some of the sample. And then we'd try to isolate the compounds that are actually causing that antibacterial effect. And there are common techniques to do that, including chromatography and mass spectrometry and things like that.
And Mark, what would you consider to be success in the ILiAD project? What does success look like?
Yeah, I think there's varying levels of success. You know, our first point here is that we want to get as many people involved as possible. We think that, you know, from a scientific discovery development standpoint, you know, a lot of the low-hanging fruit's already been plucked in the antibiotic industry. So the more people that we get, the more people that we get around the world to do this, it's going to increase our chances of finding positive hits. But the secondary point is that we just want to get people involved. We want to get people educated about antibiotic resistance. It's a huge issue. At least 2 million people get infected with antibiotic-resistant bacteria every year. And, you know, that's something that the drug community should not take lightly. And hopefully by increasing awareness, you know, we can sort of prompt them and push them in that direction.
Josiah, this isn't the first example of crowdsourcing science. I know there have been online things where people helped learn how proteins can fold. People have hunted for stars in crowdsourced projects. Is this a wave of the future for science, do you think?
Yeah, I honestly really do think it is. I think that not just crowdsourcing. I mean, I know people call it crowdsourcing because you're looking to the crowd for help, but I like to refer to it as open science, right? Mm. There's scientists out there all over the world. There's probably people out there who've never studied, you know, went to a PhD program at all that know more than me about certain topics like this. We want those people to start to contribute either by prompting them through providing projects like this or by, you know, giving them the resources that they need to do it. I think that the future you'll have projects where the whole world can contribute to a problem that affects the whole world. And that's obviously, that would be the easiest way to solve it.
Mark, I bet we've got a lot of people out there, individuals, maybe teachers, thinking, all right, I want to do this. How do I do it? Where do they go to get information and get their starter kit?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are running a funding campaign right now through the website Indiegogo. And you can go, in addition to that, the link is the-iliad.org. And that has all the information and where you can purchase the kits. And, you know, I like that you bring that point up because we've been getting a lot of correspondence from schools across the United States, across the world, actually, that want to collaborate with us. They want to get this into their classrooms because, you know, as I mentioned before, it's a two-pronged approach, educational and huge societal impact. So we're going to continue to work, moving forward, working directly with schools and directly with that next generation I spoke about previously.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
And Josiah, thanks to you as well. That was Josiah Zahner, a new synthetic biology fellow at NASA, and Mark Opel, a neurobiologist and drug development specialist. That website again, the-iliad.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Some of you might be thinking about giving a pet as a surprise gift this holiday season. Well, later in the hour, we'll hear why that might not be the best idea.
But first, the Food and Drug Administration established a new policy yesterday that places restrictions on the use of antibiotics in livestock.
The new rules are being called a major shift for national food policy, and they limit farmers to using meta-antibiotics only for medical purposes and not to enhance the size of animals.
The change is the result of a concern that indiscriminate use of the drugs in animals is creating more antibiotic-resistant diseases in humans. Well, here with us to talk about the move is Dan Schaefer. He's professor and chair of the Animal Science Department at UW-Madison. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So when did farmers begin using antibiotics, not just to treat illnesses, but as a general matter of course for livestock?
Well, I'm not totally up to date on the history of the use of the antibiotics, but I would say that the use, wider spread use of antibiotics began to occur in the 1960s.
And what's the concept there? If an animal's not sick, why are we giving them low levels of antibiotics?
Well, there was a recognition that antibiotic administration had a growth-promoting effect. And at that time, there was a search, really, for all kinds of technologies that would enhance growth promotion in livestock.
And do they, in fact, make bigger animals? And how much of a difference do they make?
The improvements, actually, I have to say that I've never done an experiment with antibiotic use. For purposes of growth promotion, at least never the use of an antibiotic that has medicinal applications. From the literature, I would say that the improvements in average daily gain are on the order of 3 to 6%.
Okay, and if you're looking at maybe tight profit margins of a farmer, that's not nothing.
That's not nothing. That's correct. It's something that would attract attention.
So the antibiotics used, are some of them at least the same ones that we might be prescribed when we go to a doctor's office?
Yes, that is the case. And those antibiotics that are affected by this policy are those that could also have a human application.
And the concern, as we mentioned, and as I gather from the FDA, is that we've got this wider spread problem of diseases that are resistant to antibiotics. They're worried here that part of the reason we're seeing those is this use of antibiotics in animals. Is there that strong connection? Do we know that yet?
Not really. I can recall an article in 1988 that claimed to have the smoking gun for connecting antibiotic administration to animals to a human illness, an antibiotic-resistant organism in human illness. And it just wasn't really very clear cut at all. It's a very complicated picture to assemble in a forensic kind of way.
And do the antibiotics show up in the meat we might get at the butcher at our local grocery?
No, because FDA would ask any vendor of an antibiotic that's used in food animal production to have assessed the occurrence and the level of tissue residues, and then FDA would have imposed on the use of that product a withdrawal time, during which time the animal may not be fed that product so that those residues which might be in the tissues are depleted.
And are there any downsides that you know of to using these antibiotics, either for the animals that are proven, I guess, so far, for the animals or for the people that eat them or eat or drink the dairy products, say?
Are there any downsides?
Like proven health impacts for animals or humans?
Proven health impacts. I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. There are, as I said, the connection between use of these products in livestock production to human antibiotic-resistant organisms is just not, it's just not clear. Mm. And in terms of animals, obviously, in addition to the development of antibiotic-resistant organisms, animals also get sick. And so for those animals that are sick, we do want to have antibiotics available to treat those illnesses, though we also don't want the use of antibiotics to compromise human health. Even though that linkage is fuzzy, I would interpret the FDA policy to be an implementation of something like a hurdle strategy. That is, you could imagine that if one wants to win a race, one has to get over a number of hurdles. And obviously, you can win the race faster if you don't have to cross any hurdles. So putting a hurdle in place just introduces a step in the process that needs to be, that is intended to delay, in this case, the development of antibiotic resistance.
So let's look at the changes that the FDA is implementing here. How would it affect a livestock farmer? What would change in their daily business?
All right. It should be understood that the widespread use of antibiotics for the purposes of growth promotion is not a common practice. What the FDA is doing is to ensure that there is not long-term low-dosage administration really under any circumstance other than that which is overseen by a veterinarian. With regards to the impact on a farmer, I am most familiar with beef cattle nutrition. I have a reasonable familiarity with dairy cattle nutrition, less so for chickens and less so for pigs. But I would say the impact of this policy is not really going to affect in a negative way those livestock production operations that are well managed, because the technology is not presently being used.
Hmm.
There are antibiotics being used in livestock production, beef and dairy, but those are not antibiotics that have human medicinal applications.
And to dig deeper into that law, those antibiotics that aren't used in humans,
mm-hmm.
farmers could still use those, correct me if I'm wrong, on a regular basis, not just medicinally. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So there's, for instance, the classic antibiotic is an antibiotic by the name of Menensin. Menensin serves to alter the nature of the organic acids produced by the rumen fermentation. And it's a product that's approved for use in beef cattle and dairy cattle. It has no connection with a human medical application, and so its continued use in beef and dairy diets will happen.
But if a farmer now wants to use something that is used in humans, I'm not sure which, maybe I can ask you that later, which ones are used, would they need to go and get a prescription now from a veterinarian before being able to use those?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Examples of antibiotics that are governed by this policy would be tetracyclines, sulfonamides, and others that I could look at on my list here if you really want to know the full list.
Maybe we could dig deeper a little bit after the news break. But why now, do you think? Why did the FDA decide to pass this ban now if we're not sure of the link between the use of these antibiotics and antibiotic-resistant diseases in humans?
Yep, very good. I would say that all pharmaceutical companies that have been selling antibiotics have known for themselves that the door was closing on widespread use of those antibiotics because of public concern because of the development of the multi-drug resistant organisms, especially noticed in human hospital infections. And so I think this is just another step in ensuring the public that their food supply is safe.
We're speaking with UW Animal Science Professor Dan Schaefer. We're talking about new FDA guidelines announced this week on how we use antibiotics in livestock.
And we'd like to hear from you, too, your thoughts and questions. Are you aware of the new restrictions on antibiotics in livestock? Are you concerned by antibiotic-resistant diseases in humans? Are you in the livestock business? What do you think about this new policy? Join in the discussion. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at talk@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion now with Dan Schaefer. He's professor and chair of the Animal Science Department at UW-Madison. We're talking about a new effort by the FDA to limit the use of certain antibiotics in livestock.
And we'd like to hear what you think, too. Of course, the food supply is something people think an awful lot about these days. What do you think or what do you know about these new restrictions on antibiotic usage in livestock? Give us a call. Join in the discussion. Here's our phone number. It's 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email. That address is talk@WPR.org.
And we'll go right to our callers. We've got Alan on the line in Rolling Ground. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What did you want to bring up?
I grew up on a dairy farm, and I just wanted to announce that the news and media and whatnot is saying in a bold statement that it's going that they want to make it illegal for antibiotics to be used in the animals, particularly cattle. In general, most of the news headings that I've seen don't specify any particular antibiotics or other drug. And I look at it in a couple of different ways. Number one, if we are not allowed to give antibiotics to our animals, I'm more referring to cows, then when they get pneumonia or diarrhea or something, they will die from that without the use of antibiotics. When they get pink eye, they will go, and that will make them blind in a very quick time, which will in turn cause them to eat less and produce less and eventually greatly depreciate their health. And if we allow that, then we as farmers are opened up to lawsuits by animal activists for not taking care of our animals.
Alan, I wanted to make the distinction between regular use of antibiotics, which is, even for non-sick animals, and the use of it for sick animals. Do you use it on a daily basis, even for animals that aren't sick, or just as needed?
There's some that we would use in the springtime to help inoculate against pneumonia when it's real prevalent, especially in the herd. And then it was also my understanding, growing up on a dairy farm, that if our cows were not did not have certain vaccines, that we were not allowed to sell our milk.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Alan. So a lot wrapped up there. Vaccines are not part of the discussion here, right, Dan?
That is correct.
Okay. But, and under the new regulations, what Alan was talking about, an animal is sick, he'd still be allowed to use antibiotics there.
Yes, that's correct. I think Alan started by saying that the news head, well, anyway, that there were headlines that were using the word antibiotic in a very general mm-hmm. way, and that would not be an accurate characterization of the FDA policy. The FDA policy applies to those antibiotics that are used for human medical purposes, and the restrictions imposed are that they could now not be used without a veterinary prescription. Mm-hmm.
So if Alan needed one of those as a cattle farmer, as a dairy farmer, he could get a prescription from a veterinarian or use one of the other antibiotics.
Yes, that's correct. And the veterinarians, in fact, according to the FDA policy, need to adhere to five different criteria before they are really permitted to write a prescription for that antibiotic, meaning that there's no other good alternative, that the disease is caused by a bacterial organism, and that the use of that antibiotic will be effective in controlling that disease. I mean, all, I would say, reasonable, responsible criteria, which still would allow Alan to have access to these pharmaceutical aids to control disease and maintain welfare of his animals.
In some of the reporting I've seen and some accusations from industry critics, there's an idea that the way animals are raised, housed, and treated makes the industry have to use more antibiotics. If we had different conditions for the animals, we could use fewer antibiotics. Is there something to that?
Yes, I'm aware of that accusation. That would fall in the same category as the overgeneralization of the use of the term antibiotic. It's an overgeneralization that simply isn't a well-informed perspective. Do animals get sick? Yes. Is it because they're overcrowded? No, not necessarily. It can occur in that way, but we go through weather changes, seasonal changes in weather. And Alan mentioned springtime, and when we transition through the spring season, we do have a higher incidence of respiratory disease in animals. So I just would say, no, it's not a well-informed perspective.
But you mentioned earlier responsible, well-managed farms. It's conceivable that a less responsible, less well-managed operation could have overcrowding, and that would make disease more likely?
Yes, that's true. And at this point, these products, these antibiotic or feed-grade antibiotics could be available for use by such an operation to control the absence of really top-level management.
Go back to our callers now. We have Carrie with us in Wauwatosa. Carrie, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. At the risk of sounding like a panic monger, the more I learn about the food supply, and particularly the meats and the dairy products that we ingest every day, the more afraid of it I become. And Mr. Schaefer mentioned that the increase in growth from these antibiotics that the FDA is saying we shouldn't be putting into our animal's feed, it's 3 to 6%.
Yes.
Given how prevalent antibiotic-resistant organisms have become in humans because of the overuse of antibiotics, why on earth, for a 3 to 6% increase, would we want to continue putting unnecessary antibiotics into our animals? We don't do that with our children. Mm-hmm. You know, doctors nowadays are very, very cautious. If if your child has recurrent ear infections, they're very cautious to not overprescribe antibiotics.
Thanks for the call, Carrie. So is this a wise decision by the FDA? Even if the complete chain isn't there, the risk that this could contribute to antibiotic resistance makes it worth what the FDA is doing.
Well, it was a judgment decision on the part of FDA, and yes, as I indicated earlier, this is one of the hurdles along the way to try and reduce the likelihood of development of antibiotic-resistant organisms that are of importance to humans. With regards to the caller's question, I was answering the question, what is the benefit from the use of these antibiotics? That is not to say that that is a benefit that is sought by all, nor is it... You know, we've come a long ways since the early days when these antibiotic research trials were conducted, and our animals are a lot more productive. There is a widespread knowledge among the food-producing population about concern for antibiotics, And so I would just want to reassure the caller that, as I said earlier, this is not a widespread practice among well-managed operations. And well-managed operations can occur as small operations, and they can occur as huge operations. The attention to management is not correlated with size of the operation.
So looking ahead with these new guidelines, these new rules from the FDA, it sounds like you're saying this is really not going to rock the livestock world all that much.
No, that is a correct interpretation. This will not rock the livestock world. And all along, or certainly in the last 6 to 8 years, those consumers who have wanted to avoid production systems that have included the use of antibiotics and hormones have been able to buy natural, so-called natural products. Natural products are produced without the use of those technologies. They cost more. They need to cost more. Because there are outlier animals, even in naturally produced food production systems, that do get sick, and those animals fall out of that production system, and then they go into the mainstream production system. So consumers have a choice in the marketplace, and the implementation of this policy is not going to rock the boat. It's among the well-managed operations, this is no big deal.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Dan Schaefer. He's professor and chair of the Animal Science Department at UW-Madison. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later in the program, we'll be talking with the author of Angry White Men about the future of masculinity in America.
First, the holidays can be a great time to consider adding a new animal to the family.
Yep, and while it's tempting to surprise a loved one with a cute puppy or a nice little kitty under the Christmas tree, our next guest says slow down. She's here with some pet holiday adoption do's and don'ts.
Ann Reed is president of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Ann, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm delighted to be on. Thanks for having me.
So it's a cliche sometimes in holiday movies that you surprise the kids or the friends or whoever with a new dog or cat. Why shouldn't we do it that way?
Well, you know what? I'm actually gonna take a little bit of a different approach. Oh. Surprises are sometimes not the right idea. Sometimes they are the right idea. It's really about being careful about all adoptions, not adoptions as gifts per se. I have to say, I come from a personal point of view. My first animal ever was a surprise gift for my 7th birthday.
Ah.
And you see where I am today. So it can be done well as long as it's done carefully. But there are also great ways to do adoptions for the holidays that are not surprises. So it just depends on what's right for your family.
So let's talk about some of those steps you take to make it right. What would be, and let's start with the worst case scenario, because
sure,
we want to hear what that might sound like. What's the wrong way to surprise everybody with that new puppy?
I would say the wrong way to approach an animal as a gift is to think less carefully than you should about really your gift recipient and what their life is like and what they really need. I think the classic example is elderly relative has lost an animal. Let's get grandma a puppy. Or let's get Aunt Sarah a puppy, or let's get if you get past sort of the romantic notion of in your own mind of how nice it is to have a puppy around, you remember that puppies get you up in the middle of the night, and puppies whine, and puppies need to eat often, and puppies require a lot of care. So in order to do this well, you really have to think not just about the specific care needs for that animal, which is true in any adoption as a gift or otherwise, but also kind of get out of your own head and really think about your gift recipient and what would be most satisfying to them.
So don't give them the puppy that you want. Try to figure out what they need.
Exactly. But at the same time, as you're thinking about, you know, you're remembering to think responsibly about how much work an animal really is, you know, what about money for future veterinary needs? You have to think about all that. But we really encourage people to think also about the love that an animal brings into your home, the proven benefits to human health that living with an animal create, and also that benefit of helping a homeless animal get home for the holidays. And remember that too. Pets can make absolutely wonderful gifts that are remembered for a lifetime. And there's actually research about this. This fall, the some researchers connected with the ASPCA published some research that showed two really interesting things. One, a lot of times we hear, shelters shouldn't adopt animals as gifts because they're just going to get returned afterward. Well, the research shows that's not true. The odds of a dog being sent into a shelter are actually higher when the animal comes from almost any other source other than a gift. Animals received as gifts are less likely to go into shelters than from almost any other source. And the other thing the research showed is receiving an animal as a gift has either positive or no impact at all on how much people love that animal. People love their gift animals just as much as if they got them otherwise.
Interesting. Well, let's get to some of the how-tos. One piece of advice I saw is to create an adoption kit. What is that?
Oh, that's a terrific idea. So, you know, there's this whole spectrum of how you can do it. You can do the total surprise, or, and this can be really fun, bring that person in on the adoption process. So, say, for example, you've decided that a kitten is the right idea, like the one I got when I was 7. So what the gift is a litter box, a cat bed, some cat toys, some food, one of those fishing pole toys that the kitten jumps over, and then a trip to the shelter after the holiday. Remember also, often things are pretty hectic in your house over the holiday itself, and sometimes the best time to bring that animal in your home isn't holiday morning itself, but maybe a week or so later when things have started to calm down. So the kit is just perfect for that.
And that makes sense, too, because you can get maybe after any holiday travel, too, because the last thing you'd want is, hey, here's a new kitten, here's a new puppy, now we're going on the road.
That's right. That's right. Well, and something else, too. I mean, as I say, I'll never forget the kitten coming out of the box when I was a kid. But that did one thing I didn't get to experience in that time that's very, very special, is that moment when you choose, when that child or that relative makes eye contact with that animal and says, this is the one. And when you bring your loved one into the shelter to help choose the adoption, they get to have that moment of falling in love.
Let's talk about preparing the home for a new pet. And let's say it's a home where they're not replacing a pet necessarily, but just sort of getting ready.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the holiday season, everything breakable that you have is sort of out on public display.
Cat playland.
Yeah, cat playland. There you go. So, you know, some practical tips. How do you get that house ready for that puppy or for that kitty or whatever's going to be walking through the door?
Sure. Well, you know, and again, gift or no gift, that is something you have to think about. For a young animal or for any animal that's new to the home, it's helpful to the animal and very much to the family to focus, especially at first, on one small area where that animal is going to spend most of its time, whether that gives it a place, if there are other animals in the home, to sort of be alone and get used to those animals a little bit at a time, whether it's to keep that puppy from chewing on the kitchen cabinets. That might be a crate. It might be a small room. And then the other piece, of course, is also I have a bowl I treasured very much until my cats knocked it off the mantelpiece. You have to think about how, both for the safety of the animal and for the objects you love, to just where's that all going to be and does that need to change in some way?
A big part of cat ownership is losing your attachments to material objects, I have found.
That's another way cats help us with life lessons.
Exactly. It's very zen, man. So when we're adopting an animal, either for our own family or as a gift for someone else, this is a huge question, but how do you weigh the lifestyle that we live versus and pick the right pet to match that lifestyle?
Sure. Well, if you're working with a good animal shelter or another really good responsible source for that animal, we'll help walk you through that. Our main conversation that our adoption counselors, and this is true at many other good shelters as well, have with you is all about lifestyle. We've already looked and sort of gotten to know the animal. So there are animals that we are really looking for, that person who's doing a daily outdoor long run or getting lots of other exercise in their family, that we know is going to be great for this dog. And we have other, to keep talking dogs for a minute, where if you watch TV a lot, we know this dog is going to love to curl up and watch TV with you. So that's just a good conversation.
I've got kind of a wild card question here. So say you've got a family and say there's more than one child. And so you don't want to get just one pet. You want to get one for one or two children. Is that a good idea? Or is that, again, something that you have to look at on a case-by-case basis?
Really case-by-case basis. Often, of course, you know, in many families, there's one animal and multiple children. And I can think of dogs where it takes the energy of three or four children to use up all the energy of that dog. On the other hand, at any given time, most shelters have animals that need to go home together, who've lived together for a long time, were brought to the shelter for whatever reason, and we're looking for a home that needs two. Or two kittens, for example, is we love those kitten two-packs. So it really depends on you, your family, but we can accommodate either way.
And make the case for adopting an animal versus buying one.
Well, there are, first of all, most the classic puppy store, that animal typically comes from a puppy mill situation that you do not want to support. Not always, but very often. And it's just not a condition for animals that you want to support. There certainly are lots of wonderful and responsible breeders out there, but the fact is that our animals in shelters need help. They are homeless, and we need to send them home. And in order to keep animals in the shelter system alive, we have to keep sending those guys home. So we're so grateful to everybody who chooses adoption.
You know, we've been focusing a lot on people here and our needs. But, you know, it is the holiday season. And what tips do you have? Because, you know, during the holiday season, it's busy. You've got people coming and going, lots of lights, lots of. How can we make sure that, you know, our cats, our dogs, our pets stay healthy and sort of somewhat sane during this time of the season?
Sure. It is important. And again, you get to know your animal. There are animals for whom this is a blast. They're having a great time. They'll be sad when it's over. Other animals definitely do need some space and some quiet and some time to relax. But you know what? So do we in these times. So that time that we're helping our animal sort of relax a little bit, it's great for us as well.
And of course, some of us have pets on our Christmas shopping lists. What are some ideas for good gifts to give to our pets?
My personal hope is that I will get out and get my dog a little Christmas sweater with snowflakes on it. There are so many things that your pet will love. I just bought a candy cane shaped chew toy for a friend's dog. We have a retail store here at the Wisconsin Humane Society at each of our shelters. Most shelters do, and of course there are great other places to get things for pets. And I don't know about you, but my animals always love whatever is new.
I don't know about you, but my animals always love whatever kind of food we give them. So we just give them a little extra.
One thing I would say is do be careful of diet. It's easy to overtreat animals through this time. And just remember that stomachs can be delicate, and it's good to stick to normal food and not give too many treats.
Hey, getting back to the idea of bringing a new pet into a family, what are good ways to introduce kids to the responsibility of helping care for that pet? What's a good starting point for
them? It's what a tremendous opportunity, and so many of us learned it when we were kids. Is one of our chores was to be sure that animal was fed. You know, it depends on the age of the child. Very often that chart on the refrigerator, you know, dog gets fed morning and afternoon, and the star that goes on the chart. You just think about those simple things that the animal needs but even the littlest children can really make an important contribution to the health of an animal.
Well, Anne, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, thank you.
Anne Reed has been with us. She is the president of the Wisconsin Humane Society.
Well, we know Wisconsin Public Radio listeners love their pets, and they love sharing pictures of their pets. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe I'll ask Amanda to create a spot to do that if we don't have one already. Send us a holiday picture of your dog, your cat, your reptile, your bird, whatever you may have. It can be our little Central Time pet photo gallery. We'll watch out for that. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in today for Veronica Rickard. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.